This episode is brought to you by Hearst Ranch, grass-fed beef raised on California's Central Coast. Now available online through Larder Meat Company. Learn more at HearstRanch.com.
Hello, welcome to Japan Eats, and Happy New Year. I'm your host, Akiko Tema, a food writer and the director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes a deep understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. This show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi at every day in the supermarket, but what is beyond sushi? We hear dashi ramen izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is so mystery for many people, and I try to demystify it in this program with my cool guests. My guest today is Marcus Consolini, who is the CEO of Daimon Shuzo, a sake brewery in Osaka that was founded in 1826. It is extremely rare to find non-Japanese management at the traditional sake brewery like Daimon. So today we'll discuss Marcus' unique background, why and how he decided to manage the authentic sake brewery, what changes he made at the brewery so far, what is special about sake and Japanese culture to him, and much, much more. But quickly before we start, Japan Eats is available on the Heritage Radio Network website, as well as on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. So please go to iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify and subscribe to Japan Eats. And please write a review. We really appreciate your feedback. Now let's start our conversation with Marcus Consolini. Hello, Marcus. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Akimashite, omedetou gozaimasu.
Omedetou gozaimasu.
Happy New Year. It's great to be on your show, Akiko. You do a great job and a great work for the industry and the Japanese culture as well. I love it.
Oh, thank you so much. Your words are a very good start of the year for me. Thank you.
Yeah, Happy New Year.
So we have a lot to talk about. First of all, where are you from and what did you eat when you grew up?
Well, actually, I'm from your part of the world where you are right now. I grew up in New York City. I was actually one of the few that have been born and bred in the city, Manhattan, and spent the majority of my upbringing between New York City and the countryside of Massachusetts-Connecticut border where my grandparents lived. They were an Italian immigrant family that had moved into the United States, and my parents had met in New York City later on in their lives, and that's where I was born and raised with an older sister. It was just the two of us and our two parents, but we spent a lot of time up in the country. So that was kind of my upbringing as it sits in the location, yes.
Right. So I would imagine you ate some nice Italian cooking when you grew up.
We did, actually. Food was always a very central part of our family environment. Not just Italian cooking. My mother was a professional chef, and so food in the household was always the focus. Everything from, ornate breakfasts to start my day, fresh squeezed orange juice, anything that my mother would cook was pretty much homemade from the get-go. And then my grandparents obviously followed in that suit. My grandfather at certain stages of his career was a butcher and a baker. And when I grew up, I have photographs of spending time with my great uncle making grappa and wine in the backyard. So food culture was very much a part of what we did or how we lived when we were growing up in those days.
Wow. That was far beyond what I imagined. Your mother was a professional cook and making wine at home, like, grandparents. It's really hardcore. So that makes sense that,
to them, it's kind of interesting. To them, it wasn't hardcore. To them, it was something that you just did. And which is very interesting, because when we talk about Japanese culture and Japanese food, and I guess the purpose of your message, what you get out there, the Japanese are still very grounded in a food culture. And that food culture is, it comes naturally. I was, as you know, I'm just coming back from a long trip, a I was caught in a snowstorm on my way back from Kanazawa today. And in the back of my trunk, I was carrying skimono or pickles that my mother-in-law had made for our journey back. So I think that the Italian culture and the Japanese culture have a lot of similarities in their just kind of acceptance that the creation of food is just what you do. It's not an extra task. It's just how you live your life.
Right. Yeah, I agree. I think both Italian and Japanese people think food as gift from nature. So it's not something you decide to make. It's just a given every day on a daily basis. That's, I think, is something in common between Japanese people and Italian people.
I agree.
Right. So I was looking at also your background, and I heard you have a black belt. So you can tell us more about it.
Yeah, I do. And actually, that's kind of interesting. I have a black belt, and the martial arts was my introduction into the world of sake, strangely enough. And I know you'll cover that in your questions. But yeah, it started with the martial arts. I've been studying martial arts since I was about 12 years old in the United States in the beginning. And then later I took it overseas, and my martial arts training has included a lot of different styles of karate, and then Japanese iaido, which is swordsmanship. Using a live blade. So it's been a very interesting experience, you know, as a gateway into the Japanese culture.
Wow. I didn't expect this answer to come. Right. So you are the CEO of Daimon Shuzo in Osaka, a traditional sake brewery that was founded in 1826, almost 200 years ago. But your background is solidly in finance, and you also are the managing director of a major asset management company based in Hong Kong and Japan. So when and how did you become the CEO of the traditional sake brewery called Daimon?
It was a really interesting experience, and it happened very serendipitously. I was traveling back and forth on a regular basis. I've been based in Asia Pacific for about almost 25 years now. And I've been living in Hong Kong, doing business across Asia Pacific, spending a lot of time in Japan. I've always been traveling back and forth wherever I was based in Asia into Japan. So Japan has been a core part of my career and my life. This is the third time that I've physically been based out of Japan in my career. And I was doing a side project where one of the hobbies that I have is I love finding old historic buildings across Asia Pacific and then renovating them. And I was launching a project in Kyoto. It was just, it's just a side hobby. It was a traditional Japanese machiya, which is the traditional, kind of row house model that the Japanese had, in places primarily like Kyoto and also other unusual places like Kanazawa that I mentioned earlier. But, while I was doing this, starting the plans to do this renovation, I had an architect, and the architect told me, he said, "Marcus, you're very, very interested in Japanese architecture," which is, part of the hobby of studying Japanese architecture. He said, "There's a very interesting piece that you should see. There's a place that you should go called Daimon Shuzo." And that's exactly what happened. It was on a Saturday evening, and I supposedly had an introduction into the brewery, although, that wasn't quite the case, but I showed up at the doors of Daimon Shuzo, and I walked in to look at basically the architecture of this 200-year-old sake brewery. And at the time that I walked in, Yasutaka Daimon, who was the sixth generation family Kurumoto or brewery owner, and the Toji, so he was actually a master brewer, was walking out of the brewery when I walked in. And so that was my first introduction into Daimon Shuzo. What then happened is that Daimon-san and I started talking to each other immediately, and I'm speaking in Japanese and he's speaking in English, which was very, very strange. We very quickly hit it off and had a great conversation. And subsequently, we had several conversations after that. talking about the industry, talking about his specific brewery and what that brewery was going through at the time, and basically building up a relationship. And what I learned very quickly was that the brewery had been going through its own evolutions, and it was in a situation where it was on the marketplace, and that there were some significant interest in the brewery, but not to keep the brewery alive. It was very, there was some interest in the land value. Diamond Son at this stage was still producing, but he had really focused on the product itself, and less so on the driving of the business. So he was doing the Master Toji's part of it. And through our relationship and conversations, I very quickly realized that there was an opportunity. So I went out to the marketplace and started looking at how we could assist Diamond Brewery to take it into the next evolution of where it is today. Very exciting opportunity, but one that I did not plan on.
Wow. But for Diamond Shuzo, you are like an angel, literally an angel investor. And it's really interesting because the sake brewery, Diamond is not the only one who are facing hardship in managing financially and also, you know, as a capability doing like you said, making sake as well as managing company. And they have to, at this point, they have to market their sake to many places beyond Japanese borders. So, yeah, I think it's this is a very particular, amazing example of sake brewery. Diamond Shuzo hit the gold mine, but this is one of them. I think it's so many other kind of unfortunately declining sake breweries. So, yeah, I'm so glad that you happened to, through the Kyoto project, you happened to visit Diamond Shuzo.
Me too. And it was a life changer. And to your point, you know, right now I'm the first foreign, you know, representative director, as what in the Western world we call CEO, of a sake brewery in Japanese history. And you're right, there is a strong decline. If you look at the history of sake production, the majority of the breweries came out as a result of families having excessive land ownership and rice production. This is kind of in line with what happened in America. If you think about the forefathers of America and the signers of the Declaration of Independence, they were all farmers, and they had excessive amounts of produce that they were creating, and they couldn't take it or sell it all to the market during the course of the year. So they started producing things like alcohol, and the Japanese weren't very different from this. They did something very similar. And so a lot of sake producers were originally landowners, and then they became sake makers, and they focused on that as their craft. But there is a decline across Japan, and there has been for quite some time, in the world of futsushu. So what we say is the average sake grade. And that decline has been happening since about 1976, which was pretty much the peak of the sake empire in Japan. And these sake owners, these kuramoto, these family businesses, have had to reinvent themselves, and it's not easy. Not only do they have to reinvent themselves in their own market because they're used to just selling around their neighborhoods and their immediate market, they've had to expand that into their prefectural regions and even further beyond that into other prefectures, but they've had to look for opportunities for international sales and export growth. And that's not easy. And it's very, very intimidating for a lot of these breweries. So intimidating that they would rather not engage in the export market and just focus on the domestic market, even if it's a decline.
Right. And at the same time, for example, American market is almost exploding, and the USA market is the largest export destination. I think almost 20, somewhere between 25 and 30% of the total export. So yeah, I see people, sake brewers come here to New York and other parts of America to promote their sake, but I tend to see the same breweries, because I think the majority of breweries have no, capacity to be able to do so. So, yeah, it's a shame, but hopefully someone like you are going to promote their motivation to go abroad. So we talked about this, the history of sake industry, but what is the history of Daimon Shuzo and what types of sake do they make?
Yeah, that's a really good question, because the history of Daimon Shuzo is actually intertwined into this comment that you made about the breweries that are making it over to the United States. Daimon Shuzo started in 1826, six generations. In some ways, I even consider myself the seventh generation, which is kind of funny. six generations of a family business. And it started basically with the Daimon family. Daimon family was a predominant family in the local area, Katanoshi, which is it's about 30 minutes by public transportation out of the center of Osaka, and it sits right on the border of Nara and Kyoto. So it's in a very interesting position, because 30 minutes from a geography perspective, I can be at the center of Osaka, I can be in the center of Nara, and I can be in the center of Kyoto. And this brewery started with the intention of making sake. It was a really interesting time, because 200 years ago, the Osaka brewers was a very small community, partly because they were merchants. And so what they were doing is they were buying the sake that was being made over in Nara and Kyoto and Kobe, which are three very big regions for sake production, and they were shipping it all around Japan. So it was kind of interesting that Osaka was starting to build its own sake production, but much like any alcohol production anywhere in the world, local communities want to have their local sake. So that's kind of where it all started. And then the objectives over the years was to make a sake that was conducive to the local region. And in this case, for Daimon Shuzo, the unique part was that the local region was this border between these three states. So it meant that Daimon Shuzo had to kind of adapt its sake to fit with a certain profile that would make the food culture of these three different distinct cities and these three areas. And to give you an understanding, and you know this already, but to give your audience an understanding of what that means, the food culture in Osaka is very much fun and lively and social, and it's very street-oriented with things like okonomiyaki and takoyaki. And then you go into environments like Kyoto, where it's much more traditional. It's where the aristocracy have dined. It's where the emperor has built certain food profiles with kaiseki ryori and these kinds of things. And then you go into the oldest of cultural heritages of the region in Nara, where it's very Buddhist oriented, and it's a sleepier type of culture, and the food is very focused on vegetarian type, Zen oriented Buddhist food cultures. So these three different food cultures has forced Daimon Shuzo over the course of the years to really focus on what we call a kamigata umami style. So most producers will tell you that their sake is either of a dry nature or of a sweet nature, or it's high acidity, depending on what they're trying to portray. And yet we're probably in the camp of about, I'd say maybe 10 to 15% of the brewers across Japan will mention or will stress that their sake is an umami profile. And so what we're trying to achieve is an umami profile that can work with these different food cultures that are basically right at our doorstep.
Interesting. Yeah, sake is unique in the sense that it has umami. Wine doesn't have much umami. And that's why sake is very convenient to pair with food. and very forgiving because of the one of the reasons is there's umami in it. So, yeah, I haven't tasted Daimonshu Sake, but I really have to look for it. And I found that in 2020, Daimonshu was awarded the silver and bronze medals at the reputable international sake competition in London, and called that's the International Wine Challenge, which is major.
Yes.
So, congratulations.
Thank you very much. We've actually done quite well in international competitions since 2018, when we started to enter into these competitions. And part of the reason is because of this umami profile. The other thing that I think is in, there's two other things that I think are quite unique and interesting about Daimonshu and our sake from a profiling perspective. The first is that there's only about 3% of breweries left in Japan that are using flowing mountain water as their mountain water source or the water source. If you look across the whole of the country, about 60% are using well water, and about 35% are using municipal water. So they're using local water that they then wash or they purify. And then there's a very small percentage left, under 5%, that are using flowing water sources. And strangely enough, although we're based in Osaka, we sit right at this borderline with Nara in the Ikona mountain range. And that gives us access to an incredible subclimate in the mountains that are literally on the backside of the brewery. And so we get all of our water from flowing water source that is in the mountain and has been part of the Daimon family for 200 years. And that makes what we think, you know, what the market will call the terroir of sake, but we think that adds a very special character to our sake. And then the other thing that's quite interesting is that Daimon-san has had a lot of experience with overseas and international travel. He lived in times in Europe and in India, and he understands foreign palates. And so as a result, what he does besides focusing on just the umami is he's constantly looking at how each one of our products can be uniquely different. So whereas some producers will change maybe the polishing ratio in a recipe and keep other factors relatively similar between different products, we reinvent each one of our products from the bottom up. So each type of our sake is going to be unique, and that gives us a lot of depth and breadth of experience when it comes to the production side of making special sake.
Interesting. So going back to that, you know, the mountain water, like flowing water, that means a high minerality than other sake, brewery sake in general?
Not necessarily so. Actually, our water, our mineral content is quite neutral, which makes it very easy to work with as a brewer. Hard water has an effect on your fermentation cycle. Soft water has an effect on other components of the actual production cycle. And so we're kind of right in the middle. But it also means that the filtration process is quite natural. It's, you know, water flowing over rocks and stream beds and this kind of stuff. And then it goes into a charcoal filtration system we bring it down into the brewery, and then of course we put it through microorganism filtration systems as well to get it clean as for production. But it is a very neutral water for us, and so we think that gives us a lot of flexibility when it comes to creating an umami based style.
Right. And also, Daimon-san, it's funny that he traveled around Europe and India. So, I mean, Europe, the food can be diverse. I'm not sure how many countries he's visited, but India sounds like, you know, think of diverse spice flavors. Doesn't mean that it's hot, but the spice is the width of taste and flavors. That must be really influential to his sake. And like you said, his sake is very successful in an international market. So this one thing that, I mean, other breweries may want to think about, how do you pair with sake, sake with other kind of food? Because in Japan, if you live in Japan, it's like sake has to be tasted with Japanese food. Like, you tend to think that way, but it is not at all.
You used a phrase earlier. You said it's very forgiving. It is very forgiving. Sake is a wonderful drink to go with all kinds of food, and it's much easier to match with certain foods because of the way that it's constructed and its acidity count. It's a really nice pairing. And Diamond-san, like you said, he had this diverse, you know, experience internationally. He spent some time in France. He spent some time in Sweden, and traveled around the region in Europe. And then, like you said, he went over into India, and that has a very, very different taste profile. So those things had a real big impression on him, and definitely, you know, sat in his mind as he learned to become a toji, because first he came back home, basically as the prodigal son, to take over the business, and it didn't become a toji for another 20 plus years. He ran the business with his father, and then when his father passed away, he was the sole driver of the business. And then a little further down the road, he decided that he was really so interested in the production of it that he wanted to become his own toji brewmaster, which is what he did. And he brought those experiences into our sake production. And when it comes to international competitions, yeah, it's been a very positive experience.
Wow, that's amazing. So what is special about Daimon Shuzo among many other sake breweries to you personally?
To me personally, well, the fact that I've dedicated my life to it is the first thing. You know, it's a special place, and it's a special place for many reasons. One, obviously, we believe that the sake is unique and the sake is very good. But as Diamond-san would say, no matter how you want to categorize it or how you want to analyze it, he'll just look at you and he'll say, just enjoy it. Just enjoy it. So we believe that our sake is something special to enjoy. The geography of the land and the brewery itself, to me, is very powerful. Having this kind of inaka or countryside experience yet so close to these major cities is very unique. And I think that kind of creates a mystical feeling when you're at the brewery. The brewery itself is very unusual because basically we have three geographies. We have a 300-year-old house, which was the house that Diamond-san was born and raised in, and the supporting gardens to that house, which are very traditional Japanese-style gardens. And then we have a 200-year-old brewery, and when I say 200-year-old, I'm saying the beams and all the structures of the brewery are the original beams. It's just, it's a powerful piece of architecture. And then we have a production environment that now is 60 years old. So it looks old and worn, but in its day, it was the first concrete structure that was made of any sake brewery in the Osaka region. And so there's a lot of history here that makes it very, very unique. And that history to me is even more important because, you know, I had this opportunity to suddenly be there, and then had to figure out how I can help and assist. And then once that happened, I realized how important it was for me to be here full time in order to manage the business. It wasn't something that you could manage from afar or in a distance. And so that suddenly meant that my family was involved. I have a young daughter, and my young daughter plays in the garden of the brewery and calls Diamond-san grandpa. And Diamond-san has two sons that we've been able to convince to join the business. So these two sons have taken on roles within the brewery as well. It's very much a family event. It's a family place. It's a family experience. And that is going to be special for anybody who gets the opportunity to experience it.
Right. Well, before you gave me the whole answers, you said you devoted your life, and literally you really devoted your life to the brewery. I didn't know this to this extent. Your whole thing changed just by visiting the brewery one day.
That's exactly right. And the interesting thing of that moment was when I realized that the brewery needed help. I then went out to raise capital, obviously, to invest in the brewery, to make sure that the brewery would go into its next evolution. But it was more than that. It was very quickly realizing that that help had to be a permanent thing. So we brought in a bunch of investors as well that have added value and have continued to promote and to help with sales and to help with expanding the word of Diamond Brewery, and it expands the family in itself. And it really becomes a very special, unique project. And part of the reason why that can happen is Diamond San himself and his family was very inviting. And I think that the environment being in Osaka is very inviting. I have a kind of a joke that if I was in Akita Ken, they probably would have tarred and feathered me by now. But because I'm in Osaka, you know, these people are very generous and very curious and very outgoing and social. So it makes it very easy to kind of come in, and you're a little bit more accepted than you would normally be in revitalizing what is a traditional, hardcore, you know, cultural business, which is not so easy to enter into.
Hey, that's interesting. I mean, actually, Osaka, the city itself, once you go into the city of Osaka, there's a different vibe, and people speak with different accent. And the way they speak is more straightforward, and it's funny. And I really love being in Osaka because of that energy. But yeah, so I'm glad you're there and enjoying your life there.
It's a great place to be. I think I've spent three tours or three times living for extended period in Japan. I did just under 2 years in Nagoya, 3 years in Tokyo, and now I'm 3.5 years in Osaka. And I loved Nagoya when I was in Nagoya, and I loved Tokyo when I was in Tokyo. And now I have to say, I really love Osaka. I think, and not just Osaka, but the Kansai region. The diversity of within 1 hour being able to go to a place like Nara, Kyoto, Osaka, Kobe, drive over to Shiga Ken. I mean, this is just it's a really special part of Japan, and it's very easy to access. And then it's always great to come back to Osaka and have this kind of relaxed social atmosphere, which is quite unusual. So I've been very lucky to find such a spot. And I'm obviously a member of the Osaka Brewers Association, and so I attend all the events and the dinners and sake tasting events that we host and everything like that. And they've been very welcoming, and they've been very engaging. And in many ways, you know, where I thought that I would meet resistance, it's been the opposite. They kind of see me as the foreign contribution to their family. And so when we do tasting events, you know, they turn to me to be the loud, boisterous New Yorker who's suddenly, you know, calling people in, irashaimasen, bringing people into crowds so that they can enjoy sake. And it's a nice balance. It works very well. I'm very lucky.
Hey, and I'm sure your daughter, 4 years old, starts speaking Osaka dialect. That'll be very cool.
She does, actually. over the weekend, we saw the grandparents and an uncle and aunt, and the uncle and aunt it was an introduction of a new family member. So my wife's brother recently had a baby, and so I was meeting my niece, and my daughter was meeting her cousin. And it was really funny because everybody kept on talking about my daughter's Osaka Ben, her dialect. And it's kind of cool. It was nice.
Hey, that's super cute. All right, so we'll take a quick break here. And when we come back, we'll discuss what has changed at Diamond Shuzo since Marcus joined the brewery. So please stay with us.
This episode is brought to you by Hearst Ranch. The Hearst family has raised cattle on California's Central Coast since 1865. Today, Hearst Ranch's signature product is their 100% grass-fed, completely hormone and antibiotic-free beef. The Hearst Ranches have always treated their animals with great care. their cattle live a completely natural existence as foragers and grazers. Well-managed grazing fertilizes the land naturally, sustains a seasonal rhythm to the ranches, and produces a remarkable meat whose flavor is the authentic taste of the American West. Hearst Ranch beef is available seasonally, May through August, in select Whole Food markets throughout California, and all year round at their retail locations in San Simeon and Paso Robles. And now, HRN listeners in Arizona, Nevada, and California can get Hearst Ranch beef delivered right to their door through Larder Meat Company. Go to lardermeatco.com and shop the 100% grass-fed box to stock your freezer with Hearst Ranch beef. That's L-A-R-D-E-R, meatco.com. Learn more about the storied history, farming practices, and conservation efforts of Hearst Ranch at hearstranch.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Japan Eats. I'm your host, Akiko Tema, and my guest today is Marcus Consolini, who is the CEO of Daimon Shuzo, a sake brewery in Osaka that was founded in 1826. So what is your role at Daimon Shuzo, practically speaking, and how do you split your time between running a financial company and a sake brewery?
So the role at the brewery itself is an oversight role, and my passion, obviously everything is my passion, but my passion is managing everything on the facility side. We have a restaurant on site as well. And then everything on the production side and liaising with international sales, so export sales, and then assisting on the domestic sales side, which is run with a team that's based at the brewery. So I see the team every week, and we engage 100% on what's going on in the marketplace and what we're trying to achieve in our targets and this kind of stuff. It's pretty full on, and it's not something that you can regulate, meaning I can't say, okay, I'm going to only be at the brewery 2 days a week. It just depends on what the activities are. In addition, I've got a full staff of brewers, but we get people that suddenly come in on sick leave and they can't attend, and then I brew. So I'm in my fourth season now of brewing as well. Wow. I'm like the emergency backfill brewer. And that's the nature of the business. When I started with Daimon-san 3.5 years ago, there were really only two people left in the brewery, and now we have 15. So all those people have been brought on to support the business, whether they're brewing, whether they're selling, whether they're working in graphic design and marketing, whether they're working in the office side of it. All these people have come in since we relaunched the business. And that requires a constant, set of eyes and a constant set of attention. But we're lucky. We've got a lot of good people working on this and driving this project forward.
Hey, okay. So what changes have you made since you joined Daimon Shuzo?
So in the very beginning, the obvious approach for me was to hit into the international market. Obviously, because I've got experience across Asia Pacific, but because I'm a foreigner, and so that target of how do we get into the international market when we haven't been into the international market for several years was the first focus, and the second focus was really how do we penetrate more of Kansai. So we're in Osaka, but we wanted to be the number one recognized jizake or craft producer in Osaka, and that's our target. And part of the reason for that is because Osaka's population is a very healthy population. They're a very big drinking population, and they're also a little bit ethnocentric. They love Osaka. Osaka's for Osaka. So we wanted to capitalize on that and provide a sake that we think, they would want to champion. So we've spent a tremendous amount of time focusing on the Osaka marketplace and then our immediate neighbors. And when I say immediate neighbors, of course, that means, places like Kobe and Kyoto and Nara, but on the fringes, not necessarily in the deep side of those cities, but really on the borders where the border lines are blurred between Osaka and that prefectural area. And so that's been a big portion of what we've done. And then from the very beginning, my personal focus was to get into Asia Pacific, not necessarily America. And part of the reason for that was because America's far away. America is a great market. And we have a product in America that's called the Road to Osaka, which is a great, we really like this name because it's the only product in the marketplace that has the word Osaka in it. And it really rings true to what we're trying to portray. And we bring that into the United States. And that's a recent thing that's happened since pre-COVID, just pre-COVID, we launched into the United States. But prior to that, the focus was really on Asia Pacific, and that's what our focus remains now. So we're, you know, constantly building more inroads into China, into Taiwan. We have a very, very successful following in Hong Kong, moving into Thailand, other countries across Asia Pacific, Singapore. We have a very good following. The idea being that it's closer to home. It's easier to educate because the Asian community has been drinking Japanese sake for 100 years and drinking their own rice wine of whatever sort that might be, depending on the country that you're in. But so that was the original focus. So really building out those two marketplaces, how do we do more in the international marketplace focusing on Asia? And then how do we do more in Osaka and our borderline regions? So that's taken the last 3.5 years of our time, and it'll take the next 30 years of our time. I think it's a big goal.
Right. Well, I feel very hopeful about, you know, the way you see the market globally. There are so many opportunities for the sake industry. So yeah, I look forward to what we're going to do what in this, I don't know how many decades it's going to take for Japanese sake breweries to revive, which I believe. So we'll see.
It's happening. It's happening. As you pointed out, you know, the American market is growing, and it's growing tremendously. And all international markets are growing. And that's the result of the interest of Japanese food culture, which makes it a very unique alcohol. The negative to that is it's not going to be a gin. It's not going to be a whiskey. It's not going to be a sudden boom type alcohol. It's always going to be something that's associated with Japanese food. And then slowly, those people who have really adopted sake into their life start pairing it with other foods, and then it just becomes one of their many sources of, you know, alcohol to drink. But it's growing. I am a real big believer, and Diamond-san is as well, that the Japanese market, the domestic market, will grow. It will not decline. Of course, I'm talking about premium sake. Futsushu, which is the kind of the average convenience store sake, which has its place. I'm not saying that it's all bad. Some of it's pretty fun to drink, especially when it's freezing outside and you've got an Atsukan in front of you. but premium sake, I think, will continue to grow. And the reason is because the younger generation is becoming more and more interested in it. Just like the younger generation became more and more interested in craft beer, we're seeing a very similar pattern in the sake world. And people are starting to pay attention to where the sake is coming from and who's the brewer and what are they trying to do as a brewer and what are the unique things that they're putting into the marketplace from a product perspective. Are they experimenting with different yeasts, different kojis, and different kinds of rice? And all of these are making more and more people interested and curious about learning about sake. And I think as that grows, it'll continue to expand the marketplace.
Right. Yeah, really, I do agree. And especially, like, for example, something like my father's generation never thought of, that's a sparkling sake that's made in a champagne method, which is a lot of work, but it's a premium and people appreciate it. So that's one of the examples that I think there's a good energy started to be born in the whole industry. So yeah, hopefully it's going to happen soon that we see the sake industry like, wow, they really made a good comeback. All right, so what is the biggest challenge in running a traditional sake brewery for you?
I think the biggest challenge is those three words: traditional, sake, and brewery. A traditional business requires a tremendous amount of delicate handling. It's hard to dictate terms. It's hard to answer every task or every objective from a commercial perspective. It doesn't necessarily work that way. And one of my favorite examples is that when I started at the brewery and started revamping not only the product, but, you know, the marketing and the labeling, I also approached the pricing. And I'd say that one of the biggest challenges I faced in the beginning was convincing my team, and primarily Diamondson, about the change of certain pricing models. And the reason is because in the end, sake is priced very much to a fair market value. And sake producers, they are very much in line with themselves. And part of the reason is because there is a cultural significance of them being in line, and they don't want to stray away from that. They don't want to suddenly be the most expensive sake. There's a sense of embarrassment at something like that. And as Diamond-san would say to me on a regular basis, he'd say, if we price our sake too high, then Mrs. Tanaka across the street, she can't afford it. And so there is a very much sense of responsibility by sake producers to make an affordable product that they can sell locally to their local community that they've been servicing for hundreds of years. And so that's not going to go away. Right. So you have to be very, very conscientious of that. And then on the sake side, you obviously need to make a product that meets both the traditional requirements of your local community as well as, you know, the unique requirements of an export community. And then you're running a brewery, and a brewery is a full-time operation, and it's 7 days a week during the winter season, especially as a craft producer. You've got teams that are in there. You've got people that are constantly working long hours in order to, work with a living creature. And that requires a very sensitive touch, like I said. So I think those are the biggest awarenesses is the cultural implication of running a brewery, not just the commercial implication. And I think that I've been lucky because I had lots of Japanese cultural experience. As you mentioned, I studied martial arts. I studied extensively the Japanese tea ceremony, traveled throughout Japan, lived in Japan. I was very lucky. I married a Japanese woman, although she wasn't raised in Japan. She was raised in England and Wales. I had learned a lot of that cultural sensitivity that hopefully has helped me, assist the development of Diamond Brewery as it goes into its next evolution.
Right. Sounds like a never-ending fine-tuning and studying, researching, but sounds very motivating and exciting to keep the balance of that delicate aspect, and also you have to meet the market's demand. So it sounds like you're enjoying it a lot.
I'm coming from, and when you talk about finance and previous roles that I've held, I've, worked in big banks like JP Morgan and investment banking and running trading floors. And while that was exciting because the markets can be very exciting and very stimulating, this is a whole different level of sensitivity and excitement, and I enjoy it very much. And I think my favorite call in the morning is when somebody's sick, and I've definitely got to spend the day, working on the production side of the business. I love doing that. That's getting your hands dirty is a lot of fun.
Right. Well, we talked about the Japanese sake industry, and that's been declining quickly over the last decades due to multiple reasons, such as competitive alcoholic products in the market, like wine and craft beer, and labor shortage and succession issues and so forth. So on the other hand, sake is becoming very popular outside Japan, as we talked. So how do you predict the future of Japanese sake? Like maybe the past, like timeline, what's your...
So to predict is a little bit tough. I think that we're going to go through quite a few more years of deterioration of the traditional breweries. And that's because of management skill set, commercial situations, the points that you've raised. Inheritance is huge. The younger generation doesn't want to work as hard as dad worked. And so that is having a big impact. And I think that will continue for a period, for quite a few more years. And then I believe it'll stabilize. And I think what will happen is that the Brewers Association and the Japanese government, and the Japanese government is doing a lot to try to promote sake, and organizations like JETRO are doing a lot to try to promote sake. And I think that will continue. And I also think that Japanese brewers are starting to tweak is the word I want to use. They're trying to play with flavor profiles and trying to create a little bit. And it's a very uncomfortable thing for a Japanese brewery to do, because if you make a mistake on a batch of sake, then you there's a financial impact that's huge. And you know, a lot of these brewers want to keep experimentation at a minimal, but they know that they need to experiment. So they're learning gradually, slowly, maybe not at the same pace as a craft beer maker, but they're learning. And as a result, they will change and alter their profile to fit a lot more into the export market and the export market's requirements. So I see a lot of upside. When I came into the brewery, one of the first things I did, actually before I decided to work with the brewery, I did a lot of research. I brought some people together to look at the export market, but also the domestic market to understand where the future trends would be. And I think it'll continue to grow. We know it'll grow internationally, and I think it'll grow domestically. So I see a bright future for sake, but... I'm going to paraphrase that by saying it's going to be organic growth. This is not an overnight sensation. You're not going to suddenly, you know, stumble upon a brewery that is, you know, going to be a giant success or a huge brand name in the marketplace. It's going to take a lot longer for organic growth to catch up and for world consumers to understand and recognize brands, because these brands are traditional brands, and they're not going to change their name to get a cool and savvy name or a funky name, or you know, they're going to use tradition as a backbone of what they're doing. So it'll take time, but I have a lot of faith in what's going to happen in the industry.
Right. I really hope so. And so what would you like to see the future of Daimon?
I want to see us continue to do what we're doing, and I think we're doing it well. Continue to make inroads into the international market, continue to be a champion of the Osaka marketplace and the Kansai region. And then there's another element that I think is really special about Daimon Shuzo, and that is in 2009, Daimon-san did an internship program. He called it the internship program. And it's really the only program in all of Japan that is a core fundamental sake brewer's course. And we offer it in English, which is the unique part. We only take 12 interns a year. We do three courses where the interns, a group of four, will come into the brewery. They'll live in the brewery, and basically they brew with our brewers through the course of a week, and they receive formal instruction by myself and Daimon-san, where they learn about how to brew sake. And I raise this because I think it's really, really interesting. It's also a great opportunity to teach the international community, and I'm a big fan and supporter of promoting the sake education around the world. There's a lot of brewers out there on the international market, and it's growing, And a lot of them have been trained at Diamond Brewery, or at the very least, they've reached out and engaged us, and we're friends. In addition, I sit as on the advisory board of the North American Sake Brewery, Brewers Association, in, you know, trying to help with that promotion on the education side. And I think that's something that Diamond Brewery will continue to do and be unique in the marketplace. How can we actually teach the future international producers of the world? And I've noticed that, you know, for example, on your radio show, you've had Brooklyn Kura on, I believe, 2 times. Great team, great guys, and very close relationship with them. It's a great example of how, you know, that ethos of taking Japanese sake into the international market is even more powerful when it's being produced in an international environment. So we support that. And I think that's going to continue to be another one of our little focus and I guess, crusades is to promote that into more markets internationally.
Right. Well, that's a very impressive effort because, you know, some brewers could be like, no, we don't want to teach anybody to anybody else. That's a very traditional, narrow mindset. But now sharing is learning and expanding the pie. So, yeah, I didn't know that Diamond was such a leader of doing it. And I think I'm going to have one of the interns on the show sometime in the very near future. So
that'll be great.
Stay tuned.
one interesting point about that, you know, within the brewers associations, Japanese brewers are very, very friendly. They're very friendly is the wrong word. They're very helpful. They're supportive. They work together. They're not competitive. It's not like other markets and other products where you don't talk to your competitor and you're seen as the enemy and you're trying to take market share. Japanese sake is a supportive industry. And so all the brewers are helping each other. And the reason why they've been slow to work with the international market is because the Japanese are intimidated by either international protocols and etiquette or the language. And it's not because they're scared. It's just because they don't want to do something that might offend somebody, something that they don't understand. And so they've been slow to engage the international community in the world of sake. But that doesn't mean that they don't want to. They do want to. And they want to help other producers and other you know, soon-to-be sake makers in other markets. They definitely want to help them. They're just a little bit nervous about, you know, the protocol and the cultural etiquette and the communication style. So they become a little bit more reserved. And Diamond Shuzo has the advantage of having, you know, English speaking capability. So we should use it and we should continue to be a bridge into the world of Japanese sake.
Right. Interesting. Right. So the Japanese sake industry, actually, it's interesting that it's very communal in a way because the government is organizing kind of the distribution of sake rice and yeast. And it's very, there's nothing to hide. It's a good rice, you share it. And a good yeast, you share it. That kind of mindset is very communal. And it's a very important, vital part of the sake industry to continue and thrive in the future. So, yeah. And so this is my final question. So where can we find you? Updates online? Where can we buy Diamond Shuzo sake?
In the United States, you can buy Diamond Shuzo. Well, actually, it's kind of interesting. You can buy Diamond Shuzo sake through Vine Connections. You can find it online. Vine Connections is one of the biggest jizake importers into the United States. They work with wholesale retailer across the United States, all states in the United States, and you can find it under a product brand called Road to Osaka. So all you have to do is Google search Road to Osaka, and then hopefully you'll find where you can pick it up locally. There's also another entry point into the United States. We've done a project with the Tatsuya Group down in Texas, which is a very, very unique and very successful Japanese eatery group that started off in the ramen side of it and have moved into a lot of other different food profiles, izakaya style, nabe style, these kinds of things. And we are doing a house label with the Tatsuya group that we will soon enter into the national marketplace as well. So by middle of this year, you will hope to be able to offer three different sakes on the shelves across the United States for people to all enjoy. If you're in domestic Japan, it's very simple. You just go to our website and we will ship to anywhere in Japan at any time.
That's exciting. So, all right. Right. So the website, what is the website?
For Diamond Brewery, it's www.diamondbrewery.com. And that's for the domestic marketplace. Yep.
So if people want to know more about yourself, where can we go to?
Sure.
Social media.
Social media. I'm not a big champion of social media. I do have an Instagram account that's under my name. And you can see things about Diamond Brewery. But we also have Instagram accounts under Diamond Brewery. And again, it's D-A-I-M-O-N. So it's really easy to find. We also have Facebook under Diamond Brewery, Twitter accounts under Diamond Brewery, and then if you do a Google search on Diamond Brewery, when you come up to the website's also in English and Japanese both, so it's easy to see our different products and learn more about the brewery, and then if you have any questions, you can always send email to info@diamondbrewery.com, and I will be happy to respond.
Excellent. So, well, thank you so much for joining us today, Marcus. And I know it's so late over there in Japan, so my apologies. But it was a great show, so thank you so much.
Akiko, this was a great conversation. I really appreciate it. And again, Happy New Year, and keep doing what you're doing. It's an awesome program. I'm a big supporter.
Thank you so much. So listeners, if you have any questions or comments about the show or suggestions for show topics or guests, please contact us at japaneseats@heritageradionetwork.org or akikokatema.com. Japaneseats is a weekly program and always available at heritageradionetwork.org as well as on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. My engineer is Amanda Wang, and thank you for listening. I will see you next week. Japaneseats is powered by Simplecast. Thank you for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a non-profit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thank you for listening.